Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. While Indianapolis has certainly been getting a lot of attention lately for its growing local restaurant scene, and I'll be talking about that today with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess in Indianapolis. We'll talk about what that growth means for local restaurants and about some of the challenges facing restaurants today. We'll also find out a bit more about Greg when we take a look at where the chef has been and how it's helped shape his career and where he's going. And since a team of Indianapolis chefs went to New York City this past week to cook at the James Beard House, it seems like a good idea to talk again about the recent James Beard Foundation's food conference. We'll revisit an interview with Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine about attending the conference and the importance of getting involved in national food issues. And just for fun, we'll return to the Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield, Indiana, and get ready to deck the halls as we hear again from Bob Wendt about the types of trees he grows there, including one with the surprising scent of oranges. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We tend to point out a lot here on Eat Drink Indie Radio that the restaurant scene in Indianapolis and central Indiana has been growing like crazy. One local publication even noted recently that we've seen 20 restaurants open in the past 2 months. Restaurateur Martha Hoover, for example, whose Pâté Choux empire also includes Petite Choux, two locations of Napoli's, as well as Public Greens, has said that she will be growing her business next year with the addition of another Pâté Choux, two more locations of Public Greens, and a small bar, as well as a fried chicken restaurant. Now, all this food biz action hasn't been lost on the national media. Earlier this year, Condé Nast, for example, dubbed Indianapolis one of America's most underrated food cities. There was just a team of Indianapolis chefs cooking at the Beard House in New York City, and just this past week, Zagat named Indianapolis to its list of the hottest food cities of 2016. So we are definitely feeling the love. But are there any downsides to the growth? I talked this week with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess, one of the city's top chefs and one with many, many accolades of his own, about what all the recent growth means for local restaurants. So first, let's talk issues in Indianapolis, you know, issues facing the food community. You know, we've talked a little bit about staffing, you know, and some of those kinds of issues. What do you see as some of the big things that are facing people?
Well, you know, it's with all the restaurants opening, it is very much, I think, sort of a bubble that's going to burst, and that with that bubble is going to be the same staffing bubble. There's only so many people that are going to go to restaurants and eat, and there are only so many people that can work in restaurants. So I think we're starting to feel the bulge sort of coming around the, you know, it's going to be a tough time.
20 restaurants opened in the last couple of months. I mean, that's a huge number for, I think, this size of city.
Yeah, I actually had this conversation with my 19-year-old daughter last night, and she's like, no, it's great. It's going to be a bigger city. I'm like, well, the city isn't getting bigger, just there's more restaurants. So, you know, there's a pie and there's slices and we're all taking a little smaller sliver. So, you know, I think there has to be a correction, and I think it will. You know, it's basic economics there. You know, there's a correction that always happens.
A finite amount of diners, well, or at least an amount of diners that certainly isn't growing as much as the number of restaurants is growing.
Correct.
Yeah. So we'll see that amount of diners going to a larger number of restaurants, again, you know, making the slice of pie smaller.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the city isn't growing at the same pace that the restaurants are growing. And that's not to say that there aren't some great restaurants coming and I'm not, or opening. I think that it's a great thing for a city to grow at a rapid rate, but it seems like it's an almost more rapid rate than we can really handle at this point with our demographics.
Right. So the question is whether we can sustain the growth. You know, we've had this discussion has come up in the craft beer industry as well. You know, can we support one more craft brewery? I don't know, but they still seem to be opening. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. But you're right, there's probably going to be a correction down the road somewhere.
I would think so. And I hate to think of all the people that are going to lose money, because I think there is a correction, just like the housing and you say the craft beer. I'm going to do my part to keep them all alive, but on an honest note, I really think there is there's going to have to be something that kind of tapers this, because we can't just keep growing.
Or somehow, you know, we get, you know, a huge influx, a whole, I don't know, someone taps into an untapped dining public. I don't know. I don't know if there are untapped markets out there. I would think that the people who come to your restaurants tend to go to the other high-profile restaurants as well.
Yeah, and that's my point, is there are only so many people that will pay the prices that we charge. And we're not charging a higher price. We're really, none of us are making any money at it, because it is the quality of food. It's the quality of product that we're buying and purchasing and providing. Service costs money. There's so many costs that go into this, and there are only so many people that are willing to pay that. I think that's why a lot of the chain restaurants, we talked about it earlier, as we warmed up here, I think that there's some chains that just want to put their brand out there, and they're willing to absorb some of those costs. And we, as small business owners, small restaurant owners, cannot absorb those costs. And I think there's some real danger there.
So what are some of the other issues? You know, I think we've talked a little bit previously about staffing. And that is a big problem. You know, who is going to, you know, fill all the roles in these restaurants, and who's going to, you know, fill the unstaffed positions in the ones that we have?
Yeah, and it goes from the, you know, dishwashers all the way to the chefs. Let me rephrase that, all the way from the chefs to the dishwashers. Because the dishwashers are the most important ones. I'd rather fire a cook than a dishwasher that's really good. But that being said, you know, that goes for service, that goes for everything. All these people need to be trained, and it's a difficult situation to find anyone that's even qualified, let alone to train them. And so we're just picking this tree dry. You know, it's like an apple tree that doesn't have any apples left on it. There's, you know, we can only depend on this thing for so long before, you know, the tree is done.
Well, now you have brought up a number of chefs in Indianapolis. A number of people have gone on from your restaurants to open their own places. Talk a little bit about that. Your influence is felt all across the city.
One of my biggest prides of what I do is the people that have come out of here and moved on to do their own things. I love them all, and I am so proud of that. And I've never trained them. They've bought into what I was teaching them, which was nothing more than what I was carrying on from what I was being taught and allowed to learn. Really, it's the ability to learn. I'm not going to teach you. You have to learn what you see. And I've been lucky enough to have some great people that are willing to learn that and carry it on. So, and I hope that's, you know, going back to sort of your original question, how do we continue this momentum? It's going to be the people that have learned from me what I believe in, and them to train or teach or allow people to learn from them.
We've been talking with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more from Greg as we talk about the local restaurant scene here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you're listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. And today we're talking with one of the top chefs in Indianapolis, Greg Hardesty of Recess. A five-time semifinalist in the James Beard Awards for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region, Greg is no stranger to attention, both here in Indianapolis and in the broader food world. But with awards come responsibility, he says. I talked with Greg at Recess recently about what national attention means for the food scene here in Indianapolis, but we also talked sports, a little history, and what comes next.
I think it helps a community grow, you know, a culinary community grow, which is awesome. With that comes a lot of responsibility to continue to grow it, to continue to allow people to come into your restaurant, to come into your world, to come into your philosophy, and move on, and hopefully, again, kind of going back to my last answer, allow people to understand what you believe in and believe that it is a true goal and not just for your own self-promotion, but to grow community and build this city, because that's what I've always been about. Is I came back from Los Angeles and San Francisco because I wanted to say this city can be a great city, and I'm starting to see it, and it's pretty cool. I feel really good about that.
There is a responsibility then to push the food scene forward and to help grow it. You know, a responsibility that is on the shoulders that comes along with some of these awards and some of the national attention.
No, I think so. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, growing up as a young athlete and a sports fan, I see people who go into retirement, and they always hearken back to the guy in the clubhouse, the guy in the locker room that pushed them and made them understand. You know, when you're a cocky young rookie or a third year MVP, and you get all what happens is you gotta you eventually realize that, oh wow, it's gonna go away soon, and so I think that there's that very 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 valuable lesson there, that you have to respect the ones that were before you, respect the ones that are coming after you, and just be a part of that one time stamp that's what you are.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the coming before and the coming after and that sort of thing. Describe the food scene here in Indianapolis when you first started.
When I got here, I was a cocky little son of a... I got here and, you know, I came from L.A. and San Francisco and was ready to take the world by fire. And at that time, it was Tony Hanslet's and... a few other chefs that I really respected, and but I'm sure that I was a little bit arrogant and cocky, and but I quickly realized that I wasn't going to set the world on fire, and so I sort of settled in and decided, all right, I'm going to do my part, and that felt a lot more comfortable for me, and that's where I am now, and I just want to continue on with that momentum.
How do you keep that momentum? How do you keep excited about what you're doing and where you're going? You know, how do you sustain that?
Well, I think that change is always good. I love change. Obviously, I change my menu every day, so I'm not afraid of change. But complacency is the devil to me, and You know, I'm always looking for the next thing. I'm always looking for what can I do. I know that I have actually been a victim to complacency in the last couple of years and sort of settled in. And I went through a little period there where I was sort of bored and lost my way. But I know that I'm going to be 48 here in a couple weeks, and I'm looking forward to the future. I'm looking forward to making some changes, diversifying my own, hopefully, skills and my own demographic that I've already tapped into. I'm not looking for new demographics, but I'm just looking to diversify and doing something new for the future for myself to get myself excited. I like change, and I love challenging myself, and so I'm looking forward to 2017.
So what are some of those changes? What might those changes be? What keeps you excited?
Well, like I said, I feel like I have a certain skill set, which is cooking. You know, I always say I'm not a chef, I'm a cook. But I love to cook, and I love food. And so I'd like to diversify into maybe some cooking classes, reducing the amount of hours in my life. I've got a family that I love and that I'd like to spend more time with. So diversifying into some cooking classes, maybe making some soups like I've done, some special dinners, you know, not relying so much on the normal everyday 9-to-5 or 5-to-11 business model that a restaurant is, but using these four walls that I'm in, and using them for different operations and different skills and different opportunities.
Tell me just a little bit about some of your other interests. I know you've referred to food history before, or woodworking. Tell me about that. The creativity that must play into all of these things.
The food history portion is I find it fascinating, and as the older I get and the further along in my career I get, I realize how simple food really, truly is. I'm not trying to redefine the wheel. I'd rather realize or find out how the wheel was invented, if that makes sense. I don't know. But it's just sort of, you know, I don't want to create anything anymore. I just want to know how it happened and sort of embrace that culture. So, you know, if I could ever, if anybody wants to buy a restaurant, no, I'm just kidding. But no, if I ever have the opportunity, I'd love to, and I don't even know if it exists actually, but you know, get my master's in food history. I don't know. I'm fascinated by, the idea of where food came from, because it really is just something to keep us alive. And we've taken it to this level of sort of superstardom, and I think we've lost what it really is, and that's about sitting around a table, keeping ourselves alive, and creating family. So that being said, there's that. And then the woodworking portion is food is wood is food, I guess. You know, I'd love to go and be an apprentice at some woodworkers and just be a prep cook and learn and see if I could chop my way through another 20-year career of being beaten up and into submission and enjoying, you know, at some point creating something that I was proud of.
We've been talking with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess in Indianapolis. We'll be back with more from Greg here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger, and we are talking restaurants today and focusing on the fact that the restaurant scene here in Indianapolis continues to get attention. In fact, the city just made a Zagat list of America's hottest food cities, and more national media outlets seem to be noticing what's happening here. But the growth of the indie food scene didn't just happen overnight or even in the past few years. Chefs like Greg Hardesty of Recess have been pushing it forward for a long time. But way before there was Recess, before there was even H2O Sushi or Elements, other restaurants that he launched, Greg began his career in one of the top Indianapolis kitchens at the time, at the Glass Chimney, a restaurant serving old-school continental cuisine and with a tough old-school chef as well, Chef Dieter Puska. Just out of college in the early 90s, Greg began pursuing a career in food and credits his experience at the Glass Chimney for helping to shape him as a chef.
I really wanted to start talking today a little bit about your culinary background and kind of talk about where you came from and how you came into the culinary community, because I think it's a very interesting story because you are a connection.
To me, it's a normal path to get here,
right,
where I am here at 48 years old almost. But I graduated from Indiana University. I grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Grew up on really great food on both sides of my family. Very different styles.
Yeah, what styles?
So there were there was a very Germanic influence from the Hardesty side.
Yeah.
I was born in Terre Haute, and so every Thanksgiving, every Christmas was, you know, the exact same meal, but they were good.
Yeah.
You know, and then on the other side, I think it felt like, and I've actually asked both all four of my grandparents before they passed away, what our heritage is, and none of them really seem to know it. So I've been threatening to buy Ancestors.com, trying
kit,
to figure out
kit.
Myself.
Yeah, me too.
Because I'd really love to know what my heritage is. But I feel like the other side, the Gabriel side, which is my mom's side, obviously, had a very kind of French-English feel to
that's
it. A lot of
nice,
vinegar on the table,
right?
A lot of sour stuff, which I liked. So I had that just that beginning palate that I loved all the foods. All my friends in high school, you know, they were eating peanut butter and jellies and I was,
right,
you know, eating the weird stuff in their refrigerator. So then I ended up at IU and got a degree and got out and said, I'm going to go be a chef.
But you were in political science or something,
yeah,
weren't you?
Public affairs, yes.
Public affairs, right. So what did you think you were going to do?
I had no clue.
Okay.
I really didn't.
So many of us in college,
I had zero clue what I was doing. I mean, I got, you know, I always call it, I had the dad scholarship or the parent scholarship,
right,
which is we'll pay for you to go to college. But I really had no idea. When I was there, it was just more, or what, at least for me, it was very, it was just kind of what I was doing. I was just kind of flopping in the wind.
Okay.
And I started cooking for my roommates.
Oh, yeah?
Once I got in a new apartment, I got out of the dorms my freshman year, got an apartment, and I started cooking. I bought one of those hand-hammered woks that they were,
right,
you know, for whatever reason, a British guy with a British accent
right,
was selling
TV,
hand-hammered
right?
woks on the TV, and I bought one, and I started stir-frying for my friends,
roommates,
and then I recognized this is what I want to be.
Well, now, did that go over well with the family?
You know, it was, my mom was very, very supportive,
just
because she was a great cook as well. My father was very supportive as well, but I'm sure he was the one footing the bill. So he's like, all right.
Now what are you going to do?
Yeah. So you're going to, I just paid for 4 years and now you're going to go. And my first job was at the Glass Chimney and
now
I made $6 an hour.
Oh my goodness.
It's like, okay, I'm a college graduate. I'm making $6 an hour.
Tell me a little bit about that. What was it like at the Glass Chimney? This was in the.
It was 1992.
Okay.
Yeah. So, it was, for me, it was a great experience. I played sports through high school, baseball and basketball. I've been, you know, a mediocre athlete all my life. But obviously, once I got to college, it was over.
Okay.
I still can't jump very high and slow. But the kitchen.
Yeah, what was that like?
Kind of became the new sport for me.
Okay, because that was a classic kitchen. That was a European chef.
Dieter was intense. He was basically the coach.
Okay.
I was part of a team. We had a game plan, and we had to execute that every night. And if somebody's going down, then you can either support them or, you know, somehow figure it out.
Right.
Being yelled at didn't bother me. And Dieter was, he was.
Was he? Was he?
He was somewhat
was it
vocal.
Intense?
Yeah, yeah.
So you had that experience of that quintessential tough kitchen.
Yeah, and I feel very, very fortunate. I don't think that exists anymore.
Well, I think we're
for
moving
one, for
farther
the,
and farther away.
The discipline of it. And I was of a generation that I think that could take it.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I don't know if these younger chefs coming up can be told that they are pieces of, you know, blank and absorb it. And then, two, I feel really, really lucky to have been a part of an old-school continental cuisine kitchen, where I learned a lot of the classics. And really what we're doing as chefs now is kind of everything's been invented. We're not reshaping the wheel. We're just
right. You're just using things that were
doing
have,
things,
have
and
been
so
there,
I
right?
really have seen some of the old stuff that really I feel very fortunate enough to know. When I'm doing it, I kind of know what it was supposed to be, you know,
right.
or what it was in the 50s.
Right.
And I thank every day for Dieter for providing that for me.
So that's how you learned.
Yep.
You know, that's how you now. So you didn't go to culinary school.
I did not. No.
So that's very interesting. You know, so many chefs today. You know, we hear so much about culinary school and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, I just, I had done my 4 years.
Right.
So like I did my time. Because I was not a very good student. My 2.63 GPA will it pretty much speaks for itself. But I did learn. I grew up. I went from 18 to 21, and learned a few things, and realized that the world that I wanted to be a part of was not whatever I studied.
Right,
and it became. This is my passion. Let's go for it.
We've been talking with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess in Indianapolis. Stay with us for more from Greg here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, and we're talking today with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess in Indianapolis, one of the city's top chefs and a 5-time semifinalist in the James Beard Awards. We've been talking awards and the challenges facing local restaurants, but I also wanted to hear about where the chef has come from. Greg tells us about how, after working in Indy for Chef Dieter Puska at the Glass Chimney, he and his wife Susan headed to California, and how he worked for some of the most highly regarded chefs there before heading back home to open his own restaurants here.
You went and cooked with some of the top chefs in the country at the time.
Yeah. Literally, we were at a Christmas party, and my wife is an occupational therapist, works at Eskenazi, formerly Wishard, has been there since she graduated from Indiana. I overheard her talking about this traveling occupational therapy program, and we could go anywhere in the country. They would pay for our apartment. They'd pay for our moving expenses.
Oh, okay.
And the amount of money back then, it still is. I mean, I can't even imagine what she could make now, but was just off the charts. It's like, okay, why aren't we doing this? And that's what I literally said. I said, wait a minute.
Right.
Am I hearing this right? At this party, I said, why aren't we doing this? And that was a Christmas. And we had moved to L.A. by April 1st.
Oh, my goodness. So you took advantage of it.
We literally said, let's do this. And we had no kids at that point.
Sure.
Our lease was up in our first
okay.
apartment after we got
right.
married. And it was just like it was perfect timing.
So where did you go? Where did you cook with?
We went to Los Angeles. We lived in Marina del Rey. And once again, just sort of by fate, I feel like my career has been sort of just always been sort of blessed all the way through the process, and it took about 2 weeks to find a job, and I applied to a position. I happened to notice that the chef de cuisine of this restaurant, his name was Rainer Schwartz. He was Austrian, and then Joachim Splichow, who was the main chef of all these really up and coming. It's like Wolfgang Puck and Joachim were both in L.A.
Oh, absolutely.
Wolfgang had all the fanfare. Joachim was the real deal. again, I didn't even know it. I didn't know who I was applying for. I just applied for this position. I drove, 18 hours on the 405 to get to downtown Los Angeles. Got home, and there was this broken English Austrian accent. And I think because I had worked for Dieter, who was Austrian,
right.
I think there was just some connection there. I was offered the job. I had no idea what I was getting into. I was like, okay, I'll do it.
Oh, my goodness.
And then, lo and behold, 6 months later, I'm realizing that I'm working for the best chef in L.A.
Oh, my goodness.
Again, just sort of right place, right time. My career has been sort of blessed like that.
Now, how did you find your way back to Indianapolis?
Well, from there, we moved to San Francisco. Joachim was such an influence on so many people that Tracy Desjardins was the chef at Rubicon at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in typical my fashion, I woke up one day and said, hey, Susan, let's move to – my wife, Susan. Let's move to San Francisco. I'm tired of L.A. And so we packed up everything that we had, which wasn't much because we, we were living pretty lean at that time. I took everything in the little tiny U-Haul that we had. I drove it up to San Francisco, put it in a storage unit, flew home, lost my wallet on the flight.
Oh, my goodness.
And 2 days later, we got in the car and we drove around the country for about 7 weeks without
wow.
jobs, without an apartment, without really a
oh,
home.
My goodness.
We just kind of drove around. And then we came back, but I kind of knew, and I actually got the job offer in Yellowstone Park.
I
called Tracy Desjardins from a payphone because there were no cell phones back then. This is like 1996.
Yeah. So you were there.
And so I called Tracy Desjardins from Yellowstone and said, and she's like, well, I don't have a sous chef because I had been a sous chef. I'd made my way to sous chef in L.A. And I was like, I'm not looking for sous chef. I want to go backwards. I feel like I've gotten ahead of myself and I need to learn more about food. So I got hired as a line cook. And then to answer my long-winded explanation, how I got back to Indiana
right.
was my first daughter, Juliet, was born in San Francisco. And I became a 2-year stay-at-home father. And the first 10 months of that were with her in San Francisco. And it just got to the point where we needed some family, some friends.
Sure.
We didn't have any friends,
Right.
We were 28 years old, and nobody was having kids. They were all in San Francisco, and it's tough to find any help. So
you came back.
So I came back, yeah.
Yeah. So what was what were you coming back to?
Well, we were coming back. We always knew we were coming back. My goal was to be skilled enough as a chef to bring back. I left here knowing that I was coming back.
Okay.
That was my goal.
All right.
I wanted to establish Indianapolis as a good food city. And that was 1997. That was 1998. I opened H2O in 2000.
Things were just starting about that time, late 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just really excited and probably a little too cocky, a little too arrogant. But I thought I was going to set the world on fire. I had fallen in love with sushi when I was in San Francisco.
Sure.
It was just like, if I had a day off, that's what I did. I just ate sushi,
So you wanted to come back here and do that here?
Yeah. So I decided to open it with my best friend, the godfather of Juliet, and both of my kids, actually, Gloria and Juliet, with Mike Sylvia, who's mm-hmm. – I just spent an hour today with him, talking with him. He still does the books, but uh, he uh, you know, just my best friend, and I said, hey, let's open a sushi bar in Broad Ripple. Not really Broad Ripple, though, just kind of outside of Broad Ripple in the worst location that anybody's ever seen. And we'll call it H2O, and I think he actually came up with the name. And, yeah, a couple of white kids from Indiana opening a sushi bar outside
in Broad Ripple,
a really good place. And for whatever reason, it worked. Again, sort of going back to that, just my career has sort of been blessed by right place, right time.
What was the city's food scene like then?
You know, at that time, I had worked for Dieter, and the Glass Chimney was still, you know.
It was still here.
Still there. And, you know, Peter George has always been a good influence, and he's, you know, still a good friend of mine. I kind of hearken to the maybe arrogant cockiness of myself, and I'm sure he probably disliked me a little bit, you know, coming in here. But we've since become, I think, pretty good friends, and I consider him a mentor based on what he's done for this city. You know, he was doing it a long time before I was.
Well, 1985 is when, you know, he opened Peter's down in Fountain Square, as a matter of fact.
85. I was a sophomore in high school then. So,
oh, my goodness.
You know, so it's pretty amazing that, you know, and he's still going.
Right.
I don't know if I'm going to have that kind of longevity. So,
so how did you get from H2O to Elements?
Arrogance.
Again?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And ego. You know, I was making sushi, and as everything in my life, I get bored. Just like, let's move to San Francisco, Susan. I get bored with things really quickly. And I was loving the sushi, but then I started adding specials and sort of doing the French connection, you know, or the French-American, contemporary American foods specials. And, you know, got a lot of pats on the back kind of thing. And, you know, so, oh, let's two restaurants
two
are
restaurants
better than one, you know.
Right.
Twice as much money.
Now, what, that
half the money, five times the work.
We've been talking with Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess in Indianapolis. You can find out more at recessindy.com or look for the restaurant on Facebook. As we mentioned earlier in today's show, several local chefs cooked recently at the James Beard House in New York City, and it's significant that more local chefs are becoming involved in national issues. Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, who has cooked at the Beard House himself, recently attended the James Beard Foundation's food conference, and in this interview from early November, tells us what it was like and what chefs can learn from such industries as technology and even fashion.
Yeah, I attended a conference in Western Montana with about 15 other chefs, and the James Beard Foundation hosts these boot camps across the country and kind of bring chefs together, and they talk about each boot camp is around a single issue, and the issue that I was there for was food waste.
Oh, and okay. Very, very appropriate for a chef.
For sure. And the conference basically started off with the stat that 40% of the food that's produced in this country is wasted.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is the most shameful thing in the world.
Right.
And you think that, like, maybe it's transportation. Maybe it's from the, you know, the farm to the grocery store to the restaurant. Like, things are lost or spoiled along the way. And that, like, represents just a minuscule amount of the waste. When in reality, the waste really occurs in homes and in restaurants.
What we throw away.
What we throw away. There isn't a set way or a regulated way countrywide of dating food.
Sure.
So, like in the state of Montana, milk has to be thrown away after 14 days, even though pasteurized milk can last up to like 26 or 28 days.
Oh, my goodness. So right there is a huge amount of waste.
Yes. And a lot of these things, it's just... It's so common sense that if you changed like the dating on something or if you allowed things to be donated, like there's laws against donating that milk to a food shelf where it would make a huge difference if, you know,
if they just could.
Yeah.
Right. So now how does this how did the bringing up these topics impact you as a chef? So, you know, you had some time to process that. What was the result of that boot camp for you?
Well, I think when you're confronted with a statistic like that's so large that it's shameful and it is an inspiration to act and to like find out what else is out there. And immediately, you know, we looked at like what we did at the restaurant. We looked at our portion size, you know, like we looked in our compost bin. And like, and first of all, like how many restaurants compost?
Well, that was my point. I was going to say that, you know, well, you have a compost bin, right?
But yeah, we look at what we're throwing away and we're looking at like, do we need to be throwing that away? Like, can those, you know, carrot tops be something? Can those radish or turnip tops be something? Can, you know, we do something with the leftover bread? But also like, I'm known for putting a lot of food on the plate. Like, am I putting too much food on the plate? Are people finishing their entrees?
Well, now that's a question to ask, right?
Yeah. So I literally spend some time like kind of digging through the trash and spending some time in the dish pit during service, something that I never do.
Right.
It has the benefit of, it's found money in a way. Like if you're putting less out there, or if you're salvaging something or reusing it or repurposing it, you know, it's going to affect your food costs in a positive way. But it's also, you're not putting, you know, six big bins of trash out every night. You're putting, you know, three or four. So that's the first place I looked, was just at the restaurant. And then obviously at our home too, like, do we need to make so much?
Right. And you know, I'm terrible about, you know, buying things and then they get stuffed away in a crisper drawer where they don't get crisp. They just get squishy and then they get thrown away, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I guess just seeing that statistic of 40%, and then when you look at like how many people in this country are actually hungry, and like I'm also a little bit ashamed that I didn't know like the extent that, I mean, I realize that hunger exists and that, you know, people struggle, but there's 40 million people in this country that are food insecure.
A shameful statistic.
We're the richest country in the history of the world. It's not that we don't have the product. It's not that we don't have it. We just lack the, you know, political will to change things. And, you know, I'm willing to do, you know, I don't know, whatever I can in my small part of this to hopefully, you know, change that.
Now, how did you get involved in the boot camp? Was it something you had to apply for, or how did that work?
I applied years ago, and
interesting.
Yeah, it was. I've been always a fan of the James Beard Foundation, and fortunate enough to cook there a few times over the years. And I applied years ago, and they were looking for someone from this part of the country to represent, you know,
the Midwest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I guess my application stood out enough, and I went to the boot camp and. Made some great friends and made some great connections, and I guess made enough of an impression that I was invited for the food conference.
Now, tell me, before we go on to the food conference, what else happened at the boot camp? What, you know, what went on? It was over several days.
It was a day and a half, and literally every moment of our day from 7 o'clock in the morning until like 1 o'clock in the evening was spoken for. Which was great. We were a captive audience, and they only had us for a short amount of time, so we made the best of it. But they gave us some advocacy training as far as, like, you know, if you're in a room, like, we have elected officials that eat in our restaurants.
Of course.
And if you have a moment with them, you can say, you know, hey, like, what do you feel about this, or how do you vote on this? And there actually are scorecards out there where you can see where your elected officials, where they rank on food issues.
Okay.
And
right. So that's some good,
it usually falls along,
right?
Party lines, but sometimes it doesn't. But that's the thing that also struck me as kind of interesting, is a lot of these things, a lot of these changes that can be made are kind of that they should be bipartisan.
Oh, sure.
And they should be. They are common sense changes, like changing the labeling on some milk so you're not throwing away good milk. I mean, who can't get behind that?
Right.
So there was a lot of that. There was like, how do you approach somebody in your community, or how do you approach one of your elected officials? And we did role playing, and we did a lot of like back and forth. And the people that facilitated the meeting, one of the guys, his name is Michelle Nishan. He has a company called Wholesome Wave that basically increases, like, people that are on SNAP benefits can go to a farmer's market and they get double the amount of product at a local farmer's market. And this guy's written parts of the Farm Bill, and all these people have this like great background in like in, you know, how to lobby on behalf of, you know, hunger relief or you know, people that have those issues.
Now, is that a sort of an unusual role for chefs? I feel like you're getting more and more out in front of the public, and so maybe this is a natural progression.
I think that chefs are leaders in their community. I think that we're pretty visible, and I think that. You know, our story is an easy one to tell. And I mean, we're associated with food, and a lot of times some of us are looked upon as experts in the food
sure.
industry.
Sure. So. Well, now I would imagine that chefs are typically very cognizant about food waste in their restaurants when it comes to what you use and you know what you can make use of on your end.
Sure. I think that you can always do more. I think that you can always find, you know, we use as much as we can of everything that comes in the door, but the nature of our society and how things are presented and how we live, we're a wasteful society. And you can say nose to tail and you can say, you know, that you use everything, but I mean, do you truly use?
Good point.
Yeah.
Right.
We've been talking with Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine. We'll be back with more on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, with all our talk today about awards and food issues, I couldn't let it slip past that it's December now and we're heading into the holiday season. To acknowledge that and to add a little bit of festivity to our show this week, I wanted to revisit a trip to the Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield, Indiana. It's time to deck the halls, of course, and thousands of people will be heading out to cut their trees this weekend. In this interview from earlier in the season, Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm tells us a little bit about the farm and the types of trees he raises there, including one that actually smells of oranges.
When we first started in Christmas trees, I called a Christmas tree expert at Ohio State, you know, to pick his brain on what to plant and, you know, weed control, fertilizer and trimming and those kind of things. And he said, well, what are you planting? And I said, Scotch pine and white pine. And he said, well, why do that? And I said, well, that's what everybody grows. And he said, that's what I mean. Why do you want to do what everybody's doing, you know, on a market that's flooded already? All right, this is the concolor fir. Just smell it. That's what your whole house smells like.
Oh, my goodness. It is orange.
It's like citrus smell.
It's citrus.
And they haven't really got the difference in the color of the needle. Their big thing is the smell.
Oh, my gosh. That's
beautiful. That's something a plastic tree can never do.
It's beautiful. How many people do you get during the season?
It's mobbed. It's mobbed. We can't... We can't keep up with it. There's so many people out here. I probably shouldn't say this because now somebody will steal a tree, but there's so many people we don't know who's paid and who hasn't paid even. There's trees coming, trees going, vehicles coming, vehicles going. But our theory is if we've ever had a Christmas tree stolen, we don't know about it. So that means either we haven't or we don't know about it, which is the same difference.
Well, and, you know, if people are coming out to get a Christmas tree, they're probably going to pay for your Christmas tree.
That's what we figure. You know, we never get a bounce check. We've had one or two we had to run through twice, but nobody ever's written us a bad check. And, you know, our joke is that, well, if we were selling drugs, probably we'd get a lot of bad checks. But who's going to write a bad check for a Christmas tree? Aww. Nobody.
So now when does the season for Christmas trees start? Does it really start at Thanksgiving?
It really does, and people buy earlier and earlier, which is one reason we've had to go to these strange varieties of trees. You think about it, a tree's a living thing, and if someone's going to cut that tree off at Thanksgiving and some want to keep it up till New Year's, you know, that's a long time for a tree cut off, even if it has water. But with the firs, they have a lot better needle retention than some of the older type of trees that used to be grown intentionally for Christmas trees. And we sell probably 50 trees before Thanksgiving.
Really?
Sometimes okay. As early as the 10th of November, which I hate to run anybody away, but when they come that early, I tell them, be sure and get a fir. Don't get, a spruce, because it just won't last. And then our first big weekend is Thanksgiving weekend, that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We're really bushed, Monday morning, we're whooped everybody. And the whole family helps, the daughters, and we have shakers and balers. And we have some kids that work for us. I say kids. We've got one that started when he was 15, and he's 36 now and has kids of his own, but he still comes and works every year.
Oh, my goodness, how fun is that?
Well, it's a fun job, and usually... The way we get our workers is we call the vocational ag teacher, in Greenfield, and we say, whenever one kid graduates or moves away, or, you know, we need more, and we say, who do you have that's a good worker that's interested in trees and wildlife and nature? And he always gives us good names. And whenever we hire a kid, usually he stays, you know, until he finally grows up and leaves the country. I mean, our workers stay 8 or 10 years, and Kathy feeds them good. She always brings out lunch for everybody, you know, and we treat them good too, and it's a fun job. Everybody's cheerful then, and we don't ever ask any worker to do anything we don't do.
So how long does the season go? Are people out here right up until Christmas?
Yep. I remember one time I found a tree cut in the field, just laying there. And I, you know, I don't know what happened, but I guess what happened is probably somebody cut a tree, and then 2 minutes later said, oh, well, let's get this one instead. So they left the one there. Well, so I dragged this tree up, and I set it out and put a for sale sign on it. And that tree, it was late. It was like the 20th of December. I thought, well, business is about gone. We're not going to sell that tree. And so help me, Christmas Eve, we were sitting down to Christmas Eve dinner. Dark enough you had to have your headlights on. I saw headlights come up the driveway. And some guy said, I'll take that tree. I got regular price for it and everything. So, you know, I mean, that's how late it goes. That's the latest we've ever sold.
We've been talking with Bob Wendt of Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield. For more information on the farm and its Christmas trees, go to lost40treefarm.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and Eat Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Chef Greg Hardesty of Recess in Indianapolis, Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, and Bob Wendt of the Lost 40 Tree Farm in Greenfield. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, and Eat Radio.